Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau, and I am your host. The mission in my work is to empower people to manifest their values of compassion and wellness in their everyday lives. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. Hello, fabulous listeners and subscribers and supporters. I hope you're all doing well. On the day this episode goes live, I will be flying from London to Belfast and then renting a car to go spend the day up north at the Giant's Causeway, this amazing geological wonder. If you haven't seen it, just type in Giant's Causeway. And that's where I'm going to be spending the day. And then we're going to be driving back down to Belfast, where we'll take the train to Dublin. And we'll spend the following week in Dublin. We're going to meet some fabulous Dubliners at an event that the group Vegan Ireland has organized, which is on Wednesday, November 5th. So if you're hearing this and you're in Ireland near Dublin, I hope you can join us. And by now, by the time you listen, I'll have already been to London and have had the vegan drinks, meeting all of you at London Vegan Drinks. But I'm not even in London yet, so I'm recording this before I go so that we didn't have to delay the episode and that you didn't have to wait for one, since I like to stay on schedule. But I'm aware of what the day will be on the day we release this. And so, of course, when I get home, I look forward to filling you in on all of my escapades in London and in Dublin. And don't forget, I already have a couple episodes on Ireland and the UK. There's one on York, and there's the Lake Country, and there's Edinburgh, and somewhat of Glasgow. I can't remember. We went to Glasgow for just a night. We didn't really see much of it. But you can definitely find these episodes. So go to joyfulvegan.com and go to the listen page, and you can find my SoundCloud bank of episodes over there, joyfulvegan.com. Thank you to AAVS, the American Anti-Vivisection Society, for being a sponsor of today's podcast, who, along with all of you listening and supporting this podcast, is sponsoring this episode. AAVS is one of the oldest animal protection organizations in the United States, ending the use of animals in science through education, advocacy, and the development of alternative methods. With AAVS's help, you can help ban the use of animals in testing cosmetics and their ingredients. You can ban the sale of cosmetic products containing animal-tested ingredients. It's really phenomenal. And all you have to do is ask your congressperson to support the Humane Cosmetics Act. I want this seared into your brain in a compassionate way so that you go over to aavs.org/Humane Cosmetics Act and do not move on with anything else in your life until you urge your congresspeople to support this act. We want to get this passed. It would be phenomenal. And if you don't know who your congressmen and women are, this is an opportunity to find out. So if you go to aavs.org, you type in your address, not only will you learn this information, but you could also encourage them to support this act. So again, aavs.org/Humane Cosmetics Act. Thanks, everybody. The love just continues to pour in from all of you, even after 8 years of doing this podcast. And of course, I'm just always so grateful. It's always a treat to hear from longtime listeners. It's wonderful because I know there's some of you out there who've been listening from the beginning, and that's pretty phenomenal. And I also love hearing from new listeners. That's really the value of this medium, is that people can listen anytime and find this content anytime. It makes me feel that if I disappeared from the earth tomorrow, my contributions to creating a better world will live on. And that's incredibly gratifying. There's nothing more meaningful for me than to know I'm leaving a legacy behind long after I'm gone. I don't mean to sound morbid. Some days, like everyone, I feel like I'm spinning my wheels. Some days, like I'm not doing the best job getting my message out there. And then I wake up to messages like this from Siobhan in Melbourne, Australia. She wrote, "Dear Colleen, my name is Siobhan, and can I just say how fortunate I feel to have stumbled across your podcast? Last year, I went traveling, and my time in Africa exposed me to a world I had not yet experienced. Living in the bustling city, I never really thought about where my food comes from. However, my world was changed when I saw a young, sprightly baby goat slaughtered for an Easter Sunday ritual. My heart sank, my lungs seized, and all I could think was how and why. My whole life had been a lie. No one told me the traumatic circumstances these creatures go through. I had been asleep, and as such, my experiences were bringing me to an awakening that I would appreciate, love, and cherish down to my bones. I suppose my writing is this. While traveling, I wanted to inform myself of everything about eating animals and their byproducts, and what convinced me was you. Your words, your thoughts, your spirit, and your heart convinced me. In the end, it made sense. If only everyone could see through your eyes and feel through your heart, I know that this world, our world, would be in a different place, a place where people considered compassion beyond humans. I thank you. You provide hope. You offer peace to the heart and soul. You give strength during the unknown, and you give love. You have taught me to rejoice in the light, to be free and awaken from sleep and live purposefully, joyfully, and compassionately. You will never truly know the impact you have made on my life, so all I can say is thank you from the bottom of my heart. That you, Colleen, have changed my world, changed my views, changed my eyes and my heart to see the truth, and in the end, be happy. My warmest and most kind regards, Siobhan from Melbourne. Yeah, so that's what keeps me going, like that people can find the podcast at any time from wherever they are in the world, and their lives can be altered and their thoughts could be changed. And that just is all I need to keep going. So thank you, Siobhan, for your incredible words, and I'm grateful and humbled. And then this too, Lyria in Florida wrote, "Dear Colleen, I had to write to you to let you know how much I'm loving the 30-day vegan challenge. I'm learning so much." There were five O's, so I had to say it like that. So much, because that's what she wrote. "I am 61 years old and I have been vegetarian for 20 years. I admit, I have had my head in the sand, knowing full well that animals were mistreated and worse, all because people think they should eat dairy products. Well, my head is out of the sand and I'm loving my vegan life. I have not looked back and will never look back. You provide so much information. You answer all the questions anyone could possibly have when making the transition. Thank you, thank you, thank you." That was Lyria in Florida. Thank you, Lyria. Thanks for doing the challenge and for opening your eyes and your heart. And thank you. If you value this work like Lyria and Siobhan do, please contribute to it. I'm creating more content than ever before, and it's reaching people. It's reaching people, and it's doing exactly what we all hope it would do. Through this podcast, through my books, through my videos, through my website, I hear from people every day who've been changed by the work that you're supporting. So please go to joyfulvegan.com and become a supporter. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. And speaking of content, I hope you've gone over to my YouTube page, which you can get to via joyfulvegan.com, and go to the watch page. In my new Vegan Point of View series, I've been covering in short 5 or 6 minute segments tops the most frequently asked questions about veganism and animal rights, such as, isn't it a personal choice to eat meat? Isn't it natural to eat animals? Other animals do. Why do vegans care more about animals than humans? Why do vegans impose their values on their children by raising them vegan? What's wrong with drinking milk if the cows are treated humanely? All of the things, sundry questions and assertions that you've heard me talk about, certainly through this podcast and my other work, but now they're in another medium, in short, shareable, 5 minute little video segments. So go check them out. And subscribe to this channel, because I'm posting these videos every single Monday. So now you get this podcast every other Sunday. You get the Vegan Point of View videos every single Monday. You said you wanted more. I'm giving you more. So go check it out and please share it. Share it with everyone you know. We need to get it out there. And really, to my mind, education and empowerment is the way to do that. And I want to send a shout out to my amazing friend and super advocate, Bridie Reed. You've heard me talk about Bridie before. She answers my love letters, and she has been helping me a ton over at my YouTube page, including supervising and supporting. She and Seb supported the new animated intro for the Vegan Point of View videos. So Bridie, you are just a shining light and a shining star, and you are such a dear friend. And I'm so grateful to have your support, and I'm so grateful that animals have you on their side. You are phenomenal. So thank you. So today I'm returning to the topic of language and animals, which is probably my favorite type of episode to research and write. As you know, I am fascinated by the origins of words in general and how they relate to our perception of, and thus our treatment of, non-human animals. In particular, of course, I'm just fascinated by language in general, but I'm really interested in and love sharing with you how our language reflects and shapes our perception of and our treatment of non-human animals. So I thought it would be fun to take a look at five common English language words and see how they relate to non-human animals. This is just super fun for me, and I think it reveals so much. So maybe you'll think so as well. And it will certainly make you stop and think about words that you're using that you didn't even know were linked to non-human animals. I will just give a shout out to Dictionary. It's an app called Dictionary. And I actually am good friends with someone who works at Dictionary, and I've met a number of his coworkers. I love meeting people who work at Dictionary, and it's on the front page of my phone, my smartphone. And I use it all the time because I'll say a word and then I'll think, oh, what's the origin of that word? And what does that mean? And you start linking things together. And I really encourage you to get some kind of dictionary app on your phone and refer to it, because every dictionary entry has the etymology of the words as well. And you will get as excited as I am about etymology. I don't doubt it if you're not already. So the first word I want to start with is capricious. Capricious. Some people say capricious. C-A-P-R-I-C-I-O-U-S. And the word capricious means that you're characterized by or subject to whim, to whimsy, right? You're impulsive and unpredictable, characterized by or liable to sudden unpredictable changes in attitude or behavior. You're impulsive, you're fickle. The word capricious comes from the Italian word capriccio, from the root... Can you guess? Capro, C-A-P-R-O, which means goat. And of course, goats are known for their whimsy. They're known for their skipping about and being impulsive and just kind of being herky-jerky, which is a great phrase in itself. The meaning of the word capricious is synonymous with how goats behave. So I love that. So capricious comes from the word goat. Caprice, of course, is another word from that same root. It's the same thing. It's just the noun version of capricious. Sudden, unpredictable, or unexpected action, or change of mind, or a whim. That's caprice. Caper is another word. It means to leap or skip around in a sprightly manner, to prance, to frisk, to gamble. I love the word gamble. G-A-M-B-O-L. It's one of my favorite words. Gamble. I love the way it looks on the page. I don't know. Do you ever get like that where you see a word and you just love the way it looks as a word? I love the word gamble as a word. A playful leap or a skip. Or it could also be a prank or a trick, a scheme or an escapade, right? So if there's a caper, sometimes we think about old school kind of 1940s. If there's a heist, it's a caper, right? The Great Caper is what it would be called. And that's all built from the same root word for goat. The word cab, you're going to love this. The word cab, you know, like a, now we use it for an automobile cab, like a taxi cab, but originally it was a light horse-drawn carriage, right? So the word cab is from 1826, and it's a short version of cabriolet. Cabriolet is a word from 1763, and cabriolet referred to a two-wheeled, one-horse carriage that has two seats and a folding top. You've seen that, right? So one little carriage behind with two seats and just one horse in front. That's a cabriolet. And the short version of that is cab. And now we use it to refer to an automobile with a folding top, or we did a convertible coupe is what we would call it. And now we talk about it as a taxi cab. But it comes from the word cabriolet, which is a French word, which comes from the Italian word capriolare. And that all comes from goat. It all comes from capro. So probably referring to the carriage kind of jerking up and down, being pulled by a horse. I think it has more to do with the carriage itself, not the fact that it was horse-drawn. We're going to get into some horse etymology. But yeah, the word cab comes from the word goat as well. And then of course, Capricorn. You've heard of Capricorn, the astrological sign of the goat, which is December 22nd to January 19th, for those of you who check out astrological signs. So that's capricious from the word goat. The next word I want to cover is burrito, right? So burrito, burrito. You've heard this word before. Burrito, if you know Spanish, if you know, I guess Spanish is really has ITO, which refers to something small or little, right? So burro, which you've heard of, is a donkey. Burrito is a little donkey. And that's what the word burrito means when we're talking about some kind of dish characterized by wrapping a flour tortilla around some kind of filling, like beans. That's a burrito. And the word burrito comes from Spanish for little burro or little donkey. There's an entry from the Diccionario de Mexicanismos from 1895. That's the date at which we can date back the word burrito referring to this dish. And the entry states that a burrito is a rolled tortilla with meat. Maybe it's plant-based meat or other ingredients inside. The term burrito was popular in Guanajuato, a state in central Mexico, Guanajuato. As the dictionary entry is the only hard and fast evidence we have to show where burritos came from, it's most likely that Guanajuato is the most likely. That's really the only documentation we have to determine that. The burrito made its way into the United States in the 1900s, and the first mention of a burrito on a U.S. menu was in the 1930s. At the El Cholo Spanish Cafe in Los Angeles, though burritos had likely been making the rounds in the States before then. Usually when you see something written, you can pretty much determine that it had been around prior to it being written down. So it was most likely that in the early 1900s is when the burrito made its way to the United States, but in the 1930s is when we first see it written down on a menu. And of course, California is well known for its burritos, of course, with a huge Mexican-American population here. And the Mission Burrito became the most popular style of burrito in the United States, and that originated in San Francisco. The Mission Burrito is wrapped in a tortilla and then again in aluminum foil. So you see a lot of people eating the burrito that way. That's the Mission Burrito. But there's not enough documented evidence about, you're like, what does this have to do with the donkey? There's not enough documented evidence about how this dish came to be called Little Donkey. But I want to make sure you know that it's not because donkey flesh was served inside the tortilla. That was never the animal meat used. Other animals, yes, but not donkey flesh. So that's certain. Unfortunately, we can't be certain exactly how burritos got their name. Some people believe it's because burritos look a little bit like donkey's ears. I'm not so sure about that. Some people think it looks like the rolled packs and bedrolls often carried by donkeys. I'm kind of more toward that, but we don't have evidence of either one. But nonetheless, when you say burrito, you're talking about a little donkey, which, frankly, there's nothing cuter than donkeys, and there's really nothing cuter than little donkeys. So you can think of little donkeys every time you have a burrito. I love that. How about another donkey word? Another donkey word comes from the Dutch word for donkey, which is ezel or etzel. An ezel is similar to a sawhorse, you know, a four-legged structure you can use to support your work, right? So an ezel comes from the Dutch word for donkey, etzel or ezel. And that's how an easel got its name, because of it being a four-legged structure, like a sawhorse. It comes from the 1590s, and the word etzel meant ass. It just meant ass. Of course, it comes from the Latin asinus, which refers to donkey. The way the word came to refer to what we think of today when we think of an easel, it's the same kind of thing where, again, donkeys have been quote-unquote beasts of burden for so long. And so it's the equivalent of loading a burden onto a donkey's back and propping up a painting or a canvas on a wooden stand. So that's kind of how it came to that word, meaning donkey, used for easel, to prop up a canvas on a stand. The Dutch word was eventually extended to mean an upright frame for displaying or supporting something, in the same way that the English word horse has come to mean a piece of gymnastic equipment with an upholstered body. So you've seen people, you know, if you've ever watched gymnastics or participated in gymnastics, there's a horse, and it's the same idea that there is something on four legs supporting the weight of something else. That's essentially what it means. And developments such as these illustrate the playfulness and the wit that speakers often bring to language. That's what I love so much. You can invent your own words. That's how language comes to be. That's how words come to be. And so I'm just a huge fan of that. And I think it's really, really clever. Now, we've talked about the word ass referring to donkeys, meaning that they're stupid or clumsy. And certainly you could go back to my donkey episode called The Burden of Burrows, where I talk more about this. But I actually think that the reason we attribute stupidity or clumsiness to donkeys, calling them asses, is because I think it's the opposite, because I think donkeys are, they're so smart, they're so willful, and they have so much of their own autonomy. And I think that is what is so frustrating for people who want to control these animals. And so instead of calling them, gosh, you are so smart and you are so autonomous, they're not going to do that. They're going to turn it on the animal and say, you're just so stupid. You're just so dumb. I want you to come over here and you won't come over here. How stupid are you? And so I think that's how donkeys got the reputation of being stupid, because they are so far from stupid, it's not even funny. And as far as how the word ass, I'm just interested in this, how the word ass came to refer to our backsides, it looks like it comes from the Old English arse, which means tail or rump. And that comes from the Proto-Indo-European word orse, or buttock or backside. It doesn't have anything to do with donkey. So our backside has nothing to do with, you know, our backside when we call it ass has nothing to do with donkey being called ass. It had to do with the word arse, which is frankly one of my favorite words. I like the word arse much better than the word ass. So go check out The Burden of Burrows. Donkeys are one of my favorite animals. Honestly, I'd be hard-pressed to pick a favorite animal. We're so funny that we always feel like we have to pick a favorite. I know I do. It's just fun to kind of create lists and choose a favorite, but I don't know. It would be really hard, but I would say cats and goats and donkeys are kind of right up there competing with one another for my number one animal. Love donkeys. Okay, so moving on, cavalier is another word whose origins are from animals, and there are quite a few meanings of the word cavalier, and I don't know how much you use this word cavalier. It's also a beautiful word when you look at it written. I love the word cavalier. So the word cavalier, the noun, is a gallant or chivalrous man, especially one serving as an escort to a woman of high social position. A little archaic, I think, probably. It also could mean a gentleman. Also a little archaic. We don't really use that word to refer to someone today. We kind of think of, I don't know, probably around the more like 18th century would call someone a cavalier. Cavalier is also a mounted soldier or a knight. And then an adjective, the adjective cavalier, is showing arrogant and offhand disregard, dismissive, having a, you know, dismissive, a cavalier attitude toward the suffering of others. That would be a way we use that word still today. Carefree and nonchalant or jaunty. I don't even think I've ever used the word jaunty, but there you have it. That's what the word cavalier means. And it comes from the French word chevalier, as well as the Spanish word caballero. The vulgar Latin word caballarius, meaning horseman, from the Latin word caballus, C-A-B-A-L-L-U-S, right? So all related, chevalier, caballero, caballarius, and caballus. They're all related to the horse. So when you think about a cavalier being a knight, they rode horses, and there was just a total relationship between knights and horses. I'll talk about that in a second. But these horse-riding cavaliers or knights, they could get pretty haughty. They could be up on their high horse, as we would say, right? And they could be pretty disdainful, giving rise to the adjective we use today when we call someone cavalier. But they could also be gallant and brave, which is why we also have a related word, chivalrous. And of course, being chivalrous, being knights, they rode horses, and thus they were cavaliers. So they're all related. A cavalier was also a supporter of Charles I of England. During the English Civil War in the 17th century, there were the people who were the supporters of Charles I, the royalists, and there were the people who were, when he was struggling against Parliament, there were people who were royalists and called cavaliers, and then there was everybody else, the people who were against the royal monarchy. And that's what a cavalier referred to as well. But again, that's really more of a point in history, not the way we would use it today. And of course, there's the dog breed cavalier. You've heard of the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. It's a small spaniel, and breeders attempted to recreate what they considered to be the original configuration of the breed, which I think was more of Charles II's spaniel from the Restoration. I don't think it was Charles I, but that is what we also say. We talk about the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel as a dog breed, whatever. I'm not really that interested in dog breeds, but that's what we have there. And then we have other words with horse as the root. Of course, cavalry, and a cavalry is military troops trained to fight on horseback. So you can see the relationship there. Chivalry. Now, you've heard of chivalry. If you've had any kind of classes in medieval literature, you have read about chivalry. It's a medieval system, principles and customs of knighthood, such as bravery, courtesy, honor, and gallantry toward women. And the age of chivalry, which was really in the Middle Ages, was also the age of the horse. So you had these horses who were elaborately dressed in armor and other trappings, and it was quite elaborate, though I imagine it was pretty heavy and annoying and uncomfortable for the horses, and then you'd have an armed knight on top of this horse. But that's how you had these horses linked with chivalry, because then, of course, you had this elaborately decked out knight as well. And of course, it's all related because it's all from the word horse caballus. Another word from the same root is cavalcade, and that means a procession of riders or horse-drawn carriages. It also meant a ceremonial procession or display, a cavalcade. And now it also refers to a succession or a series. So there could be a cavalcade of Broadway hits, so a succession of Broadway hits. It's all from the Latin word horse, all of it, cavalcade. And then chevalier, as I said, is a mounted knight, or caballero, which is a Spanish gentleman, all from a horse. And then finally, another word, hackneyed. This also comes from the word for horse. And it's really interesting. So much of our language stems from our experience, right? So when you look at all of the words that come from animals, of course, a lot of these words are from animals we've domesticated, for better or for worse, right? Mostly worse for them. But because they were part of our everyday lives, all the domesticated animals, because they're in our everyday lives, quite literally, we see them every day, especially there was a time when we were much more rural and people did see these domesticated animals all the time, or in the case of horses, people rode them. We didn't have mechanized vehicles. They have been, for better or for worse, an integral part of our culture and human development. And so, interestingly, the idioms we use and the roots of the words that we use are of domesticated animals, right? So, of course, you can return to various podcast episodes on language to document this yourself, or if you're a supporter, you can document this by going through the transcripts you receive. But how many words do we have from the root word for flamingo or giraffe, right? Most of the words are from animals we've domesticated. And of course, horses were such a huge part of our development, culturally especially. And so we have so many words that are related to horses. So hackneyed is one of them. And it has a couple different connections. First, possibly referring to the place name Hackney in Middlesex, which is now within London. It was once pastoral and horses apparently were kept there. And so Hackney referred to a small saddle horse let out for hire. And then, of course, there's deterioration of that sense that happens just naturally. And there's a French word, hackney, which also was a small horse that was suitable for ladies to ride. And it came to be used as a general term for horses that were hired out because they were easy, because ladies or children could ride them very easily. And by metaphorical extension, anyone having to do drudge work. So if something was well worn from years of drudgery or years of use, like a horse, like a small saddle horse, like a hackney, then it becomes hackneyed, right? Something like a stale cliche, something is well worn out from years of use, it's hackneyed. And that's how the word came to be, because it referred to a horse that was used because it was let out to hire for so long and became hackneyed. The sense of a carriage for hire led to the modern slang for taxi cab. We call a taxi cab a hack, right? So the word hack, which I don't know how much people use it today, but a hack is a slang word for a taxi cab, right? So, and someone who drives a taxi cab, they're called a hack. Hack as in hack writer, right? So someone who's a hack writer is first recorded in 1826. And it's the same kind of correlation. Someone who's doing hack work, it's just drudgery, right? So just worn out work, uninteresting work, just hack work. And so hack writer is someone who's just doing hackneyed work. And hack, like in hack computer, like hacking into a computer, it's kind of related because, again, it's kind of like making something common to all. So when you hack into a computer, you can access everything. It's common. That's how the word hack became deteriorated to mean what we say today is when a computer is hacked into. And that, though, just to be clear, is all completely unrelated to the use of the word hack, as in to chop down. If you hack down a tree, that's a different root word altogether. But it all starts with horses. And now, like I said, we call taxi cabs hacks, which is great for the horses, but we still need fewer cars. So maybe one day we'll develop another use of the word hack, like for pedicabs or hovercraft. I don't know. But hacks is what we now refer to cars instead of the horse. So that, I think, is really interesting. So now when you say the word hackneyed, and when you say the word cavalier, like, oh, she's just so cavalier in her attitude. Or if you say the word easel, like for a painting, or if you say the word burrito, or if you say the word capricious or caper, you're going to think of goats, and you're going to think of burros, and you're going to think of horses, because that's just how language works. I think that's really interesting, and that's perfect timing, because Charlie just came in, and he said we need to get to the What Would Colleen Do segment of the podcast, and so we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to get right into the WWCPGD calls, and before we do, I want to again remind you to please support this podcast by going to joyfulvegan.com and either becoming a sustaining member or a one-time contributor, and I want to thank AAVS, the American Anti-Vivisection Society, for their work protecting animals from harm, and urge you to support their hard work and go to aavs.org/Humane Cosmetics Act and ask your congresspeople to please support the Humane Cosmetics Act. We can make this happen. Okay, a little music from Ghost of Burling. Thank you, Ghost of Burling. Thank you to Ghost of Burling for providing that beautiful music. That's such fabulous music. It's my husband's band, and it's fabulous. And you can listen to these tracks, and you can buy them individually by going to joyfulvegan.com in the shop section. And I encourage you to do that. I run to many of my husband's songs, and I love their music. I really do. And I'm really grateful to them for letting me share their music with you. So this is our time together for me to answer your questions directly. You can tweet anytime using the hashtag WhatWouldColleenDo or WWCPGD. You can go to joyfulvegan.com and click on contact to ask your question, which you can do via email. Although, as you know, I'm taking calls once a week, and so please call in. We're playing with the time, so just make sure you check the website. We had it on Tuesday nights, and I'm not sure it was the best time. It might be. We might go back to Tuesday nights, but right now I'm just trying out Saturday morning so I can accommodate people from all across the globe. So go to joyfulvegan.com. You'll see it in the menu. You'll see contact. And find out from there what day I'm taking the calls. And I really encourage you to call so we can share your question with the world. I certainly don't have all the answers. I never pretended to, but I do have a lot of opinions, and I'm happy to share them if you ask. And you're asking, so I'm sharing them. So we're going to start first with a call from Alma.
Well, I'm a new vegan. Okay. I started this year, and I started listening to all of your podcasts starting from 2006, wow. A couple of months ago. And I'm up to 2010.
Nice.
So sorry if this question has been answered in any of the other podcasts. Actually, I have a couple of questions, and we can just focus on one, whichever one you prefer.
Okay.
First, I just want to say that they're so inspiring to me. My favorite thing to do in my car is no longer listen to music, it's play your podcast.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
So, and like so many people say in their letters, I just feel like there's a friend there, mm-hmm. somebody sitting with me, and one recent one that I really enjoyed was on how to talk to hunters. That was just so compassionate.
Thank you.
It wasn't what I expected at all.
Yeah.
But as a new vegan, you know, I come across a lot of questions from family and friends, and a couple of them that I don't know how to answer because I'm not sure myself. One is about honey. Mm-hmm. It being a health food, just now I'm still kind of getting over a cold, and wherever you look for tips, it always recommends honey. Mm-hmm. And my sister said, well, how are bees harmed in the process? the other day, and I didn't really know how to answer because I don't know.
Yeah.
And I actually Googled, and I couldn't find much interestingly on death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So a couple things. So first of all, when it comes to people's recommendations to use honey because you're sick, that really is just this kind of old wives' tale that has lasted. And really, the honey, what it does more than anything is it's soothing. So it's just this, you know, viscous texture, and that is soothing. It's not because there's anything in the honey that's helping you because you're sick. It sweetens the tea. So of course, people often recommend lemon tea, right? A lemon infusion or ginger, something like that, and then honey. And the honey is in there not because of any nutritive quality, but because it will sweeten up the sour lemon, and because it's, you know, it's viscous, so it's smooth and it's soothing. So that's that. And the answer to that is agave, right? Agave nectar does the same exact thing, or if you wanted like maple syrup or something like that, but it's really not honey. And I was the kid who, when we were growing up, I could eat honey off of the spoon. I just loved it. And I would, and when I was sick, I would love it, but it's because it was really soothing and because it was really sweet. So it tasted good.
And some people just like, you know, it's so ingrained. They swear by it. Like they say, oh, teaspoon a day with honey.
I know. It's kind of romantic, right? It's got this kind of old school aspect to it, right? Because people have been recommending that for decades and or maybe centuries. I don't even know how far back it goes, but it does. And so it's ingrained. That's all it is. And so what we do is we respond to that and we say, actually, and this is why, Alma, I take longer than probably most advocates to answer questions, because I don't want to just say to them, no, agave nectar is fine. I want to be able to say, no, it's just because it's smooth and sweet that we're recommending honey, but there's nothing nutritious about it that's making me feel better when I'm sick. I want to go deeper, right? So that's what I want to be able to respond with. And then, of course, it does inspire someone to say, but would it really bees? You know, I've had that from people. I've had neighbors over, and I was catching a fly to let outside as opposed to kill him. And they were like, really, even flies? You know, so there's that kind of reaction that people have. And my answer is, if I can avoid killing someone, I will. That doesn't mean that I don't do it accidentally, etc. But if I can avoid it, yes, I'm going to let the fly outside rather than, you know, smush him. And so people have this perception that bees are inferior, as they do with all animals. So it's coming from that place of, why would you even save bees? And then it's coming from a place of genuine curiosity, how does it harm the bees? Now, if we can remember that we even have that question with regards to cow's milk or animal's milk or regards to the chicken's eggs. I mean, so this is a very legitimate question, and I'm glad people are asking. So always be happy they're asking, and always come from a place of genuine truth and understanding that they might not like the answer. Frankly, they might not even want to hear the answer, but the best you could do is give an answer that is truthful and, you know, while understanding they're not just trying to goad you. And it sounds like your sister wasn't. Sounds like she was like, really, how are the bees harmed? And so what I talk about when I talk about honey, what I really say to people when it comes to honey, because, you know, there are people who keep bees, and there's some people question whether they're actually harmed in the taking of the honey. Frankly, I think some bees are killed in just the process of taking the honey off of the combs, but that, you know, ultimately for me, what it's about is it's not mine. That the bees are making the honey for food for themselves, to store the food for themselves. They're not making it for me. And that's ultimately what I say to people when they ask me about honey or any of these questions that seem harder, you know, because we don't know the the scientific answer, you know, all of the details behind it. For me, mm-hmm. it really works to say, look, the problem with all of what's going on in the world and the way we treat animals, from elephants to bees, from elephants to insects, is that we think they're here for us. And we think that we can do to them whatever we want. And so the bees, they don't make honey for me. And you know what? Mm-hmm. I don't need honey, right?
So if we didn't take it from them, they would eat it.
Absolutely. They're making it for themselves. That's what they're doing. They're making the honey and they're storing it. And then they are also using other, you know, they're regurgitating all of this from their stomachs. And then they're making their hives with the wax. I mean, so all of the stuff that we're taking from them, they're using either to make their homes or to eat or to store to eat later. And so mm-hmm. that's the principle, is that they're not doing it for me. I don't need honey. We have no nutritional requirement for honey, period. And what happens is that you go into these health food stores and you see things like royal jelly.
Yeah.
Right. And people say, no, it's the most nutritious food. Yeah. It is the most mm-hmm. nutritious food for bees. Right. Mm-hmm.
It's like,
it's the most nutritious food for the queen bee. I mean, this is mm-hmm. That's why they're calling it royal jelly. It's all marketing. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's expensive.
It's expensive and completely unnecessary. We have no more need to eat the regurgitated food of honeybees who are making it for themselves than we have the need to drink the milk of another animal. It's all the same principle. And so, you know, so I think finding a way to say that for yourself that feels really honest and conversational, to say, look, I mean, we don't need honey. And for me, it's really about doing the best I can to not create harm and to not cause harm mm-hmm. to anybody. And so if I have a choice where I don't have to cause harm, like the example where I gave, I'm going to carry the fly out rather than kill him. Mm-hmm. If I have the choice to have agave nectar over honey, because it means that there wouldn't, that someone wouldn't be harmed by my choice, then that's the choice I'm going to make.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I agree.
If that's your truth, if that's your truth, that's
is
that's
this something I didn't know, because I can't answer a question before when I don't know the answer, you know, and I don't want to just make something up. But I legitimately started looking, and I couldn't find much, like what's done to the bees. Or,
yeah, and I agree with you. I think not answering questions when we don't know the answers is a good thing. So I think saying, mm-hmm. you know, that's a really good question. I don't know, but I'd love to get back to you on that, and then get mm-hmm. back to them and say, gosh, I mm-hmm. looked into this, and you know what? I realized we don't even need this stuff. And like the bee, you know, and you know, the bees are getting harmed when we're taking their honey, and you know what? They're making it for themselves. Why are we taking their food from them? So in the end, we don't need it. There's nothing nutritious about it. We're wasting our money because there's nothing nutritious about it. So gosh, yeah, that's what I found out about bees, and that's what you can mm-hmm. share with anybody who asks.
Okay.
Thank you, Alma. It was really wonderful to get your question. Alma had a couple questions, and we'll share one of her other questions in another episode. She is just so full of curiosity and enthusiasm for her new lifestyle, and I really appreciate her calling and asking her questions. The next is from Victoria, and hopefully the audio is good enough. I think you can probably hear it, but Victoria is asking a question about how to talk to coworkers about these issues when you don't have a lot of time to talk about them. So check out Victoria's call.
How are you in Washington, D.C.?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I'm well. So what's up?
So I work at this development bank here in D.C., and a couple of us who are vegan and vegetarian, we have come together and we're organizing a seminar on the benefits of leading a plant-based lifestyle.
Great.
And it's a great initiative, and I think it's a great first step to make it something eventually more official, because it's kind of like an informal group.
Okay.
So we're going to be four people who are speaking. One of us is going to be speaking on like the benefits, like the nutritional benefits. The other person is going to be talking more on like the environmental impact. And I've been, you know, asked to talk more about the moral aspect and the compassionate side.
Okay.
And I'm super excited, but at the same time, as soon as I, you know, was asked to do this, I immediately started getting really scared and nervous,
mm-hmm.
partly because I haven't, you know, spoken in public for a while. And the other side of me is because, you know, this is a subject that I'm so passionate about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to give off a really good impression. You know, I don't want to, you know, scare anybody off, especially with this argument, which could be, especially in like, in a professional setting like this, with the people that we've worked with for, you know, real brainiacs. You know, everyone's very focused on facts, statistics, and I think people are going to be getting a lot of that from the nutritional aspect and the environmental impact. And of course, there are a lot of, there's a lot of research on the, you know, factory farming and all the other aspects, but I'm just really nervous that I'm going to get really flustered. And I don't know if you had any good tips on, you know, since you're such a great presenter, on like what's the best approach, since we only get 5 to 8 minutes mm-hmm. to present, and then we open it up for questions. And I mean, what I was going to do was I was going to, you know, give a little bit of my background of why I became vegan, my journey to that. And then there's just so much information out there. I just wasn't sure what would be the most effective in a small, short amount of time. Sure. I don't know if that's an okay question.
No, of course. No, it's, so it sounds like your question is really about both style and content.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the practical aspects of public speaking and content, you know, how to actually choose the information you want to convey. So a couple things. When is this seminar?
Well, we just started organizing it, but it's going to be really soon. It's going to be the 23rd of September.
Of September?
Yes.
Oh yeah, that's very soon. That's great. Yeah. That's like next week.
I know. Well, they actually, it was actually this group that they got together first, and then when they heard, they, you know, they, I don't know, somehow found out about me. They, it was just like the day before yesterday, they were like, "Oh, we would love to have you as a panelist." And I'm like, "Of course." And
Of course. That's great. So yes, always say yes first and then freak out later. So you did the right thing.
Exactly.
So look, you know, the only way you get good at anything is by practicing. And that's just the bottom line. So you can look online. I mean, you don't have time to go do, you know, one of those Toastmaster courses, which I would recommend you doing, courses, whatever. You can just join your local Toastmasters group. And it's such a wonderful way to practice public speaking in a safe place, in a place where you're going to get constructive criticism. And it's a great way to share this topic with people who, you know, might not be exposed to it otherwise. So I would recommend, for kind of the big picture long term, definitely taking a course on public speaking or joining your local Toastmasters group, et cetera. And since you have such a short amount of time, just go look online. You can look at some tips for public speaking, right? So just for you to feel like you've got some skills down and some tips for practical skills, right? So that's that. As far as the content, as far as actually this topic and how to go about it, so what I heard you say was you were afraid you were going to, you know, put people off, you were going to scare people. I always talk about intention. So remember, the intention is to, well, I'm going to encourage you to get clear about what your intention is in conveying this information. And for me, my intention is always to raise awareness, to be their voice, and to speak my truth. And so with that is my intention whenever I'm engaging people individually or in a public speaking setting, I'm really clear about that, so that the bottom line is, if I'm setting forth to do this, how they react is not on my shoulders. I want to be effective. I want to be, you know, compassionate. I want it to be engaging. Those are all parts of my intention as well. But that's still isn't, and I hope they like me, or I hope they like the information, or I hope the information moves them. None of that is mine. What's mine is I want to be effective. I want to be engaging. I want to be, you know, like I said, you know, passionate, whatever. All of those, that's all mine. I can control all of that. I can't control how they react. So that's one thing to put your mind at ease. Go about it so that you're meeting your own intentions for this seminar, and the rest isn't yours. So that's just another little kind of psychological little tip to keep in mind while you're writing this and when you're getting ready to present. As far as the content to choose, I really love the idea. I mean, this is kind of how I've always done it from long ago when I did cooking classes to now even. I like the idea of weaving the facts into a narrative. And so you said that you were going to tell your story about becoming vegan. I encourage you to weave the facts into that. So I grew up eating animals, and I'm going to, you know, here's a summary. This is a very short version, but yeah, I grew up eating animals because I didn't know, I had no idea, because we live in a society where we compartmentalize the animals we eat and the animals we have in our homes as pets. And so I loved my dog, but I had no idea I was eating a pig who, you know, studies show, research shows that they're as intelligent as a 3-year-old child. They're even more intelligent than dogs. I didn't even know that, and I wouldn't have eaten my dog. So why was I eating this pig? Right. So you're telling the story, and then you're also putting in this information, and then you go on. And then I found out when I first read or saw or whatever your story is, then I found out that X, Y, Z, whatever the facts are that you want to convey, and I couldn't believe it. So I just wasn't able to be part of it anymore. And so I, you know, found out more, and then you can do some more facts, right? So you can weave it. I really encourage you weaving it into a narrative, not only because I think it's more effective, it's also more interesting. Right? People are thrown statistics and they're thrown facts, and it's boring, and you can't take all those numbers in. And as you know, I believe very strongly in narrative, and I believe very strongly in speaking from the heart. And I understand that this, you're saying this is an intellectual crowd. That's fine. They also have hearts, and you can still do both.
They like to bury it a lot, but yes.
they like what?
They like to bury it a lot.
Well, yes, and that's what people do who lead with their minds, and that's okay. So you can speak to both their minds and their hearts, and by using your mind and your heart. So that's what I would recommend for choosing the information and doing it in a way that really tells a story and also conveys that information.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. That's good.
And remember, when you are in any situation where you're invited to speak about a topic, there's a reason you're invited. So you have more information to share than they know at that moment. So at that moment, you have something to share with them. You have something to give to them, and they're there because they're interested in it. So remember that. And I really do believe that whether it's a large or small audience, you know, in the end, people want you to succeed. They want you to do well. They're very, you know, I find people to be very understanding and compassionate, especially when someone appears nervous. But don't even say you're nervous. Just, you know, just take a deep breath. They're only people. They're only human beings. It's okay. And this is really important. And, you know, again, I think keeping your intention in mind is going to be really helpful for you, so it doesn't feel so you're not so attached to the outcome.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, you make a great point, because I think what is, you know, making me so nervous is the fact that, you know, I feel like I have to be super on, like, intellectual, because otherwise people aren't going to take me seriously. But like you said, they also have hearts, and I can speak to that as well.
I think so. That's my experience. And practice. Yeah. Practice every day until that day. You will feel so much better having practice. And however you do little mnemonics and you want to remember your points, that's why telling the narrative is so much easier. Look, our language is based on the fact that our language was oral before it was written. We were able to tell stories because they were narrative. That's how we know so much of what we know. It's narrative. So when you're telling the story as a narrative, especially your own story, you know that better than anybody else. And then the other stuff, the facts, yeah, you've got 10 facts to memorize. Okay, great. But you weave them into your story and you're going to do just fine.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Colleen.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Good luck. Let me know how it goes, okay?
Okay. And thank you for all the work you do. You're so grateful and wonderful. And just keep up the awesome work.
Thank you. Have a good night.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Victoria. I'm anxious to know how that talk went. So please contact me and let me know so I can tell everybody else. And then finally, a really interesting question from Clarice.
Hi, I can't believe I got a hold of you. I'm in Florida, so I guess it's a 3-hour time difference. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I wanted to start by saying I listened to your podcast last night about animals are not plants, and I went to the American AmphibiaSection.org, and I contacted my closest family and friends and wrote to our congressman, so hopefully all of that goes well. So thank you for, I didn't tell, I didn't even know that was happening.
Oh, great. Good. Thank you, Clarice.
Absolutely. My question to you is, regarding speciesism, I'm trying to be an animal advocate as well, and I was wondering if you thought speciesism was a relevant or even a good argument to have.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the situation, right? Because, you know, I remember several years ago, so I've been contributing to KQED Radio, it's my local NPR station here, and one of the editorials that I submitted, this is several years ago now, I used the word speciesist in the editorial, and my editor wrote back and said, I'd never heard of that word before, and I had to look it up, and I was hoping it wouldn't really be a word because he didn't like it. And he said, but it's a word. All right. So, okay, there you go. So it was an interesting reaction that people have because they've never heard of it before. I think it's still really new for people. Personally, I do think it's relevant. I do think it's very relevant because I think one of the things we need to do, and I was alluding to this on the episode you're talking about, the Animals Are Not Plants episode, is that this is a social justice issue.
Right.
And if you compare it to other social justice issues and look at what the problem was and thus what the solutions are, because there's more than one solution, then you recognize that this is exactly that, that there is a certain group that is treated differently and worse because they just belong to another group and it's arbitrary. So yeah, I do. I think just, you know, kind of easing people into it and talking and educating them about it. Do you hear that popping sound? Do you hear that popping sound? I keep hearing a popping. If you don't, I will just not ask you again. Okay.
I do not hear a popping sound.
Okay, good. So yeah, I think educating people and getting the word out more about what speciesism is. I just don't want us to call people speciesist, right? I just want... Right, that's all.
I got you.
Yeah.
All right, the only reason I actually asked, because for the longest time, I thought the speciesism argument was kind of flawless, but then I came across a vegetarian the other day, and I think when animal rights activists speak about speciesism, they speak of it more in a social justice term, and they speak of it as, like, human dominance over animals. But somebody brought this to my attention that, to an extent, all species need to be speciesists in, you know, the whole circle of life things. Cause, so, you know, like lions obviously kill zebras for food and all those things. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I guess you're right, but that's a completely different, you know, scenario. Like once we stop our species from doing unnecessary harm to other living beings, then maybe we can, you know, play with the idea of, you know, the other animals, you know what I mean? So that's the only reason why I kind of brought it up, because they did make a decent point, but I was kind of like, it's an irrelevant point because we're doing things that don't need to be happening, you know?
No, I think he's misusing that word. I think he's trying to use that word to refer to other species and what other species do and does, what other species do, it's getting late, is not speciesist. It's actually... they're not choosing a certain species because they deem them inferior to them. It's just a natural, it's their natural predator prey relationship. That's
exactly
different than speciesist. We don't need to do what we do to non-human animals other than to keep our status as powerful, not top of the food chain, because I don't even agree that this is a food chain. It's a web, and You know, it's a food chain if you look at it like a food chain. So I think he's misusing that word. And I think it's, again, worth a conversation and probing a little deeper so that they don't immediately go to, well, other animals do this too. There are more herbivores in the world than there are carnivores. And, you know, it's just, it's an argument that starts to go down a road that negates what we're saying about what we do to animals. So once you start getting tempted to go down a road away from, no, but wait, this is what we're doing over here, then we've lost the argument. And I don't mean that in the sense of like, I'm only here to win an argument, but I just mean we've gotten away from the point of the issue.
And, yeah, the point of the conversation in the first place.
There's another part of speciesism that I think is really interesting. And that is this kind of like underlayer of speciesism where we've decided different animals are on the different rungs of superiority, inferiority. Well, of course, we're the only superior ones, but we've deemed certain animals as being, you know, highly deserving of our protection and care. And those would be dogs and cats, right? I mean, top of that would be dogs and cats, not even non-human primates, because of what we're doing to them in entertainment and in laboratories and what we're doing to their habitat. So really, I would say dogs and cats. And yet, even within that realm of our saying, no, we really value dogs and cats, then go to any laboratory where we're still testing on dogs and cats. And so we've even separated out species into compartments and saying, well, those are the dogs and cats that live in our homes, but those are the dogs and cats who live in labs because we need to test on them for our own use. So it goes really deep, and we're really capable of doing that kind of split even within the animals, you know, even for the animals that we say we love. So I think it's fascinating. I do think it's interesting, and I think you need to talk to that guy again.
Yeah. No, thank you so much. You really cleared things up for me, and you're very helpful. I appreciate so much what you do. Please keep it up. And I am in college, so I can't start donating yet, but I promise as soon as I get a job, I'm going to start giving back to you because you've helped me so much.
Thank you. Clarice, just keep speaking for the animals. That's payback enough.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you, Clarice. Wonderful question. Really important. And I hope that helped. It sounds like it did. And I'm so glad. So that's all I have, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you've heard, please post a review on iTunes and Stitcher and support the work if you can. Submit your own questions at joyfulvegan.com and mark your calendar to call in so you can be part of the Food for Thought podcast. Thanks again to everyone who supports the podcast and to AAVS, the American Anti-Vivisection Society, AAVS.org. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.